Hi, I'm Ali Hassan, host of CBC's Laugh Out Loud. Do you like to laugh? Because we're serving up big laughs each week. We feature comedians from across Canada. You might already be fans of some of them, and others might be new discoveries. We record emerging comedians and established pros in front of live audiences all across the country, and we promise that you'll be literally laughing out loud. You can find Laugh Out Loud on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. Big show today. Thanks a lot for listening. Even if you're not into ballet, even if you don't know a 2-2 from a 3-3, I was pretty proud of that. You should know that Guillaume Cote is one of the most celebrated ballet dancers in the world right now. You should know that he's Canadian from Lac-Saint-Jean, Quebec. And Guillaume's an interesting dancer because he is celebrated for having the perfect mix of like technical ability and artistry. Normally you have kind of more of one than the other. He kind of has a perfect balance of it. He also has a gift for taking these sort of overplayed roles like Romeo and Prince Siegfried and Prince Charming and turning them into something brand new. Guillaume started his career as an apprentice with the National Ballet of Canada when he was a child. And within a few years, he was promoted to the prestigious role of principal dancer. And over 26 years, Guillaume has danced his way into becoming one of the top ballet dancers, period, in the world. He's choreographed for a bunch of dance companies, including the National Ballet, and more recently for his new company, Côté Danse, where he's the artistic director. His latest work is the world premiere of Hamlet. It's his collaboration with the playwright Robert Lepage, who he's worked with before. This all leads to Guillaume announced that after next year's season, he'll be retiring from his home at the National Ballet of Canada. It's a big deal, so we figured we'd ask him to come in and talk a little bit about it, talk about his new show, and talk about why it's time. I'm excited for you to hear this. We talked about his earliest memories dancing ballet at his parents' dance school, how you dance gracefully even in extreme pain, and being in a speed metal band. Here's my conversation with Guillaume Cote. Guillaume Cote, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. After that introduction, it makes me feel old.
Just for people listening, you don't have a long white beard or anything like that.
No, I know, but I feel like I've had a lot of interviews lately and people, you know, I guess in dance when you're like, I'm retiring, you know, people are always going, oh, you know, is it because you're aging and this and that? And I feel younger than ever. The only thing is my knees. I guess if you took an x-ray of inside my knee joints, that's probably where I show most of my age.
I do want to ask why the stepping back and how are you feeling about it?
I feel great. I feel great because I've had the best opportunities. I've maximized my classical dance career at the National Ballet to its fullest. And it was my own decision to step away. I'm deciding to step away because, you know, the classical form, as beautiful and as incredible as it is, it's incredibly demanding on the body. You have to fit yourself not only in these sort of white tights, but you also have to fit yourself into these like very difficult sort of positions and also jumps and virtuoso kind of, you know, ways of moving. And they're big ballets. They're also really, really set. So you're sort of like, you're expressing the choreography of others a lot.
Yeah.
And I was very well known for doing that. And now I really enjoy the sort of the more collaborative way of working. Also choreographing. I really love to generate work myself. I love to portray characters and I love to dive into a process of getting to know sort of a different way of thinking, different way of dancing, different ways of moving. And I felt like with the National Ballet, I have seen 26 years, I guess, of different choreographers and of different roles and they've come and gone. And now I felt like it was getting a bit repetitive.
Yeah.
And, you know, as soon as you join the National Ballet of Canada, you have an expiration date.
Really?
You know that it's limited, just like Olympians or
baseball players, anything like that.
Yeah, you know there's going to be a better dancer coming up. And also dancers get better with each generation. And now there's some younger dancers really, really excited to sort of step into these roles that I'm finding now a little bit more mundane, a little bit more difficult to be inspired by. So it was perfect timing.
It was time.
Yeah. And now I feel like I'm discovering a whole new type of you know, I'm rediscovering my body as well, which is a really beautiful thing. Different ways of moving and exploring my body and exploring dance in general with contemporary dance. And there's so many movement patterns that we just don't do in a classical way, like yeah. With the classical form. So collaborating with all these other types of dance styles and dancers and actors, and it's feeding me in a whole different way.
We're going to talk a little bit about the new role and talk a little bit about what you get out of choreography versus sort of dancing someone else's steps a little bit later in the chat. But I want to go back a little bit with how it began. So almost 40 years ago, your parents have a drink of water there. Your parents had a dance school in Lac-Saint-Jean in Quebec. You started dancing there when you were four. I don't remember a lot from when I was four, but do you remember anything from being four in those classes? Do you remember... This feels right. This feels good.
I don't remember when I was four. I mean, you know how it is. You sort of see videos of yourself and you're like, oh, I think I remember this. But you know, the weirdest video that I've ever seen of myself, which I didn't remember, was myself in a church basement in Métabetchouan. For those of you who don't know where that is, it's by the Lac Saint-Jean, the Lake Saint-Jean, in northern Quebec.
Yeah.
And I was in the church basement and we were all doing this little sort of like dance number. And because my family, my parents' families are very large. So my dad's family's 13 kids. My mom's family's 9 kids. They all had their kids and they all had, you know, multiple kids. So then I had a lot of cousins. So there was like all these like people in this ballet school that my parents started because they wanted to support my parents. So there was all these boys, you know, I had all these guy cousins who were in gold spandex doing Puss in Boots mm-hmm. in a church basement pretending to be cats. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of interesting for me because I really grew up thinking this was totally great and normal because I was kind of isolated in this sort of little group until I got to like, you know, a little bit older in high school and then I started getting bullied a lot in, you know, in a small place like...
For what?
Well, for doing ballet, obviously, you know, like at that time, like the world has come, it's come very far in accepting ballet in a different way in the last 20 years. I mean, I've also been a big, big promoter of that because I for me to do ballet in a hockey town, it was really tough for people to understand. So apart from my family, my direct family who danced and supported my parents, everyone else felt like it was very much a girl's thing to do.
Right.
It was very stereotypical of tutus and ballerinas and things. So I wasn't popular, that's for sure.
They picked on you a little bit?
Yeah, a lot. And then even when I joined the National Ballet School when I was 11 years old, so yeah. I moved to Toronto and downtown. I didn't speak
11 years old?
Yeah, I was 11 and I didn't speak a word of English, you know. And it was during the referendum, like it was, my parents were separatists and they were very involved with that, you know, and it was, you know, the referendum, which was like in the middle of this really weird political time. And I just kind of moved to Toronto and then suddenly everyone's questioning the separation of Quebec and there was sort of tension between Quebec and Ontario and the rest of Canada. So it was a really odd time to sort of move to Toronto.
Yeah.
But then, you know, then the really beautiful thing is the art kind of transcended all this because I really love to pursue ballet and I didn't find a place in Quebec where I could do it at the level that I wanted to do it at.
I guess when does it go from something that your parents wanted you to do to something that you actually love to do?
That's a great question. You know, I still wonder about that sometimes. It's true. You know, my parents never really wanted me to do it. I think they just like the arts in general. I think they really love this idea of the abstract in a sense that like sports is very competitive and it's very, you know, and especially at home in Northern Quebec, it was a little bit borderline toxic masculinity a little bit. And so I think they really enjoyed that their young boy was doing something that was very highly, you know, achieving, but at the same time didn't have this sort of competition element to it. It was like competing with yourself more than anything else. And so I just started dancing because that school kind of was there, but they never forced me to do anything. I just never stopped. I wasn't the one who decided to start, but I also never had the urge to stop. So, right. And then at some point when I was, you know, 15 and I was at this ballet school and then things were kind of going very well, then I discovered the whole portraying a role. And then I started also really loving being in this environment and being very stimulated. I think I have, I do have ADD into a certain degree. And I think it's a really great field to be in. I think if you have a little bit of attention deficit, just because you're constantly stimulated physically and there's always an element of danger. There's always this element of, you know, you have to be paying attention. Otherwise, you can get hurt or people around you can get hurt. And, you know, so I really, truly gravitated towards staying there. And it wasn't until I was about 16 when 15 when I graduated, and then you start making decisions whether or not you're going to turn this into a job or not. I still had hopes of becoming a rock star. So I was playing in a band and it was going okay.
Original music, covers?
Original music, yeah, called the Neurotics, and we were playing bars and it was a lot of fun, and you know, and I thought I was pretty good, and then now I look back and I wasn't. But you know, the really great thing is I really enjoyed being on stage. I think that part of it was really it was really stimulating.
What a secret, weird life that was to be 15 and be in the National Ballet School and then also in the nighttime to be this guy playing in greasy bars.
Yeah, you know, it was crazy because I grew up also with a group of friends up north too who really enjoyed like death metal, like heavy metal and all that. So I grew up playing that too. Like I played that on the guitar a lot. And so I got to be very good at it because a lot of that music is actually really tough to play.
Yeah, were you tapping?
Oh yeah, all that. Like
pick sweeping?
Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and all that stuff.
Guillaume, I had no idea.
Yeah, I still do. That's what I listen to for my warm-up.
When do you, I'm always very curious, I want to touch on a couple of things you said there, but I'm always very curious as to when people who are great at an art form sort of get the inkling that they're great at an art form. And it's a weird question to ask in Canada, especially because people, I think, generally go like, oh, well, I don't know. But I want to point this out for people who don't know. So when you were 16 or 17, you started dancing at the National Ballet of Canada as an apprentice. Then when you're 19, you dance the leading role of Prince Siegfried in Swan Lake for the first time, which made you the youngest person in the history of the company to dance in that role. Did you start to get a feeling, and I know this is hard for Canadians to answer, but did you start to get a feeling that I might be a little different than the other dancers my age?
It was a really nice feeling, for sure, to feel like I understood things differently, and I understood things. I just grew quickly. I think
You noticed it. You noticed, like, hey, I'm starting to get this a little bit quicker.
Yeah, and also I was at the right place at the right time.
Yeah,
you know. And then the really beautiful thing is, I have to pass it on to the people who educated me. Like they saw something in me, and I think in all situations, whether it's art, whether it's sports, you know, it's about privilege, in a sense that if you have the right teacher and if you have the right person who's going to develop your talent at the right time and give you the right attention and be the right type of teacher as well for you, then it's going to really take off. And I was very privileged to have that. And I recognize that so much that I always felt grateful, and I always felt very, I always wanted to be one of the boys, or I wanted to bring everybody along all the time. And I think that's why I was also good on stage, because, you know, if I played Romeo, I just really wanted Benvolio and Mercutio to be in on it with me as much as I was, you know. And but I did feel like I was developing well. And then the nice thing is when I started traveling a lot around the world and dancing with different companies and things and being invited, and that really fed me in a way that it just kept kind of my curiosity. I was always very curious in nature. Yeah. So things repeating for me is like torture. And so much of ballet is about repetition.
Yeah.
So much about ballet is tuning your body and doing it every single day and doing it exactly the same way every single day. But I was lucky to have teachers who made it interesting every day. But the really good thing is it kept changing, because I kept changing theaters and I kept changing partners and I kept changing. So, and also the really beautiful thing is dance changes all the time. You're never frozen into anything, right?
All I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Guillaume Côté, one of the most celebrated ballet dancers in the world. And he's from Quebec. He's been in some of the biggest, I mean, kind of all the biggest ballets. The Nutcracker, Romeo and Juliet, the one you're listening to right now, Swan Lake. When you get an artist like that into the studio, it's always fun to ask them what goes through their mind when they're doing their thing. Like for Guillaume Côté, when he's dancing, is it euphoria? Is he in flow state? Or is he thinking, I got to put my foot here and I got to breathe here? So I asked him.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
I feel in so many ways it doesn't. It's the only place where I think when I have the greatest shows is when my brain does turn off and there's just one track and the track is just what I'm doing in the present moment. And I had this conversation with my girlfriend recently too. Then she said, you know, she misses meditating and she misses yoga so much as part of her routine and her life. And I said, you know, I never really gravitated towards it because I feel like that's my yoga. That's my meditation. When I'm on stage, it's kind of like the whole world goes away. And then I sort of end up in this really beautiful place where the only thing that's happening is the here and now. And it's because the element of danger or the element of, you know, of being watched and this whole pressure on your back to execute these things that are very difficult. And then you sort of end up in this flow for sure. I mean, there's days where, you know, stuff doesn't happen and then you fall into this, the floor's too slippery and oh my God, my back hurts.
That
and,
person didn't land their thing. Which
yeah,
means
or,
that,
yeah. Or I didn't. And yeah. What are people thinking of me and this? And I've had moments on stage too, where I snap my ACL and then, you know, then the whole world flashes before, your career flashes before your eyes. And so, you know, it varies on the shows, but the great shows are the ones where the world goes away and you can focus on either your partner when you're Romeo and Juliet, or in the case of Hamlet, you're completely within your own egotistical mindset.
Stay there on the injury for a second, because we were talking about this. So I've been lucky enough to be part of the Nutcracker twice as the Cannon Doll.
Oh yeah, you were a big hit.
Come on,
yeah,
huge hit.
I know, you brought the house down.
I sold out the balcony. They told me.
I've heard it's legendary.
It's a legendary story,
absolutely.
You know. They don't ask me back because they don't want that many tickets sold.
No, and also it sucks for the prince.
Yeah.
You know? He loses the stardom.
I remember being side stage and watching these incredibly graceful dancers that I had watched the day before in rehearsal. And they walked off stage after their dance and they were going like this. They were exhausted. My thing is when people, and I was watching the performance of you as Nijinsky and just watching, you talked about Olympians and professional athletes as an analog to the kind of work that you do. Mm-hmm. If they're hurt, say if I'm watching baseball and the pitcher's hurt, I can kind of tell.
Right.
Because he's allowed to wince a little bit. Uh-huh. He's allowed to move his shoulder back a little bit while he's pitching.
Yeah.
What strikes me about ballet is that you have to perform gracefully, perfectly, beautifully, and you might be in intense pain. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's skill. You know, the thing is, you know, it's, you know, that picture like on Instagram that everybody's seen of the iceberg, you know, like all of it, like so 90% of it is under the water.
Yeah.
And then like 10% is above, you know, so I think that's that describes the ballet career very well. So we do all these sequences in the studio a million times before we get on stage. So we have systems, we have ways of making things look easy. Also, yeah, when you are hurt and you're dealing with injuries, there's the, you know, the medication obviously is one yeah. is a definite shortcut to not being in
but
pain.
But you can't wince. You can't. Oh, you can't.
No,
you know.
You can't. And you got to wait till you get off stage. Usually, some ballets, and you know, and this will be also when we discuss Hamlet. But some ballets are made where you have some entrances and exits at the right time, so you always have kind of a moment to go and, you know, if you want to stretch your calf or if you want to do something or you need to get some physio. Sometimes during Nijinsky, I had times when I had physiotherapists backstage and they would sort of like do treatment between entrances and things
wow,
like that.
Wow, really?
Yeah, sometimes some things will shift, you know, like either like the tibia will shift a bit and then suddenly everything's not lined up and then you know, just to get through the show. But it's true. Once you get out there, you have to, Nobody wants to watch a prince who's in pain, I don't think. So I think
or a Cannon doll who's in pain.
No.
That's why they say it's the hardest job. So let's talk a little bit about this world premiere of Hamlet coming up. You're collaborating once again with the playwright, actor, and director Robert Lepage on this one. You've choreographed the piece. You play the role of Hamlet. It's not your first time playing Hamlet. I can tell it's a big moment. I can tell it's the first big gig outside of the National Ballet ever.
Yeah.
And you have played Hamlet a bunch in the past.
Yeah.
What is it about Hamlet that you're hanging your hat on?
You know, I Robert said that there's a few, including like Laurence Olivier and a few actors who have been said to say they want to play it before it's too late. And I guess I could say that as well. I've always wanted to play Hamlet in a way that I found thrilling. And I've played in the past, but most versions that I've played in the past have been more abstract representations of the story of Hamlet, which means, you know, in dance, sometimes you have a version of a story, but then they sort of take liberties on how the story is told. So it was more like just the relationship between Hamlet and Ophelia. But Hamlet is so much more complex. The story is, and the character too, is so much more complex than that particular angle. So that's why I wanted to develop it as a choreographer. And yes, it's a huge deal. It's the first thing of that size of my company, Côté Danse, which I started during the pandemic. And it's been doing well. We had another production that toured BC last week, and it did very well in New York earlier this year. But this is a huge show. This is a very big show with Robert Lepage, Ex Machina. I'm putting everything I've got into this show, and I'm also starring in it, which is so incredibly tough to be in the show and co-create the show as well. So yeah, I'm going all out on this, and I didn't make it easy for myself too. The choreography is one of the hardest that I've ever had to do, just because it started with us sort of making scene by scene. We sort of started making each scene of the play, but minus the text, drawing some symbolism and things like that from the text.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Let's get an example out. I remember when I went to see you do Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. A few months last year, maybe yep. Something like that. I took my mom and my mom. Nice. So I had never been to the ballet before. I went to the National Ballet. My mom had never been to the ballet before, but she was a high school English teacher.
Oh, nice.
And brilliant. And she, after it was over, she looked at me and she said, I didn't know how they were going to do some of that. Mm. I didn't know how they were. Oh, and I see it now. So let's just talk Hamlet for a second. Let's say that the scene that most people know in Hamlet is the to be or not to be. That is the question scene.
Yeah.
Let's just use that as an example. You don't have access to one of the most famous texts in the world.
No,
you don't have access to speak some of the most famous texts in the world. You as a choreographer, how do you approach that?
So to be or not to be was something that, you know, where he's questioning his sort of existence in general and suicide and all these thoughts that he has in his head of why even living. So in our production, I've had to have a formation in sword fighting and all this sort of sword playing. And so I have a big solo where I play with a sword. I'm sort of training and doing my sword exercises, and I cut myself. And then as I cut myself, sort of I look at the wound and I sort of draw blood from it on stage. And then I sort of start to look at it, and I sort of, you know, as you would, you sort of start sucking the blood, and then you start looking at your veins, right? And then he starts looking at his pulse, and then takes the blade that he has in his other hand and puts it up right up against his wrist. And then takes a pause and then feels the pulse in his neck. So then he takes his blade and then moves it back all the way to his neck, and then takes some deep breaths and considers for a moment, sort of slide, and then puts the blade down, and then decides. And all of that, to be or not to be, comes across within those three little actions. It's kind of chilling because it's kind of this, it's true. It's a moment that all of these thoughts kind of run through, and that's what I do when I'm sort of going through those motions, is I'm listening to those words in my mind, but those actions to me resonate very, very strongly. And to an audience, I think it's understood right away. You understand that this person is struggling with this idea of even continuing living if it's this situation that they're in.
Loved hearing that description of how he does To Be or Not to Be. More of my conversation with the Canadian dancer, choreographer, and artistic director Guillaume Côté coming up. He'll tell you why he thinks ballet is a little bit like sushi. Then you'll hear Toby fresh off winning 2 Junos at this year's awards in Halifax. That's after this on Q.
I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Canadian ballet dancer, choreographer, and artistic director, Guillaume Côté. After 26 years at the National Ballet of Canada, 20 of those as a principal dancer, Guillaume is retiring after the 2024-2025 season. Listen, this is not someone who's going to put his feet up. He's not going to start drinking margaritas at an all-inclusive. Guillaume is going to be spending much of his time focusing on his new project, Côté Danse. This week, he's preparing for a major production with Côté Danse. It opens tomorrow. It's a take on Hamlet, and it's a collaboration with the legendary Canadian filmmaker and director Robert Lepage. So, if you've been listening to my conversation with Guillaume up to this point, you would have heard him just then beautifully break down how you do to be or not to be, like the soliloquy from Hamlet, how you do it without using words, only through gesture and dance. And it became really clear that Guillaume thinks deeply about this stuff. And I wanted to ask him, are there things that you can do through dance, like emotions that you can convey, that you can't convey through the spoken word? I asked him.
I wouldn't say, I don't know if it's I don't know if I would compare like it can't in words and it can in dance. What I would say though is that it's different. It's a different medium altogether. So the really beautiful thing is, you know, if you listen to a piece of music, you're in a different world than if you listen to a text. But if the piece of music is inspired by the text, you won't get the text, but you'll get something else. So in the same way, the Hamlet that we've put together is very narrative. So it's with Lepage, Robert Lepage, and mm-hmm. he's an incredible storyteller. Mm-hmm. So the story comes across. Another thing, too, that I thought was really interesting, and you named Romeo and Juliet. And I thought that
I should say it's a role you became really well known for.
And also I had the chance to also work on the creation of Romeo and Juliet with Alexei Retmansky, one of the most famous Ukrainian choreographers of all time.
And worked with you on that to develop that Romeo for you, right?
That's right. That's exactly. Right, yeah. And I remember him actually bringing in the text in the room. And there was one section when we meet, when Romeo and Juliet meet, and there's the really famous palm-to-palm quote.
Good pilgrim, you'd wrong your hand too much. Which mannerly devotion shows in this? For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
And he wanted us to just like keep creating ideas on how we could portray that one sentence through dance. And it was such a beautiful thing because suddenly the one sentence generated all these beautiful movements. And to this day, when I dance this, it gives me chills because I feel like it has so much meaning to it. But it's, again, it's different than the sentence, but it's different. It's rich. It's rich in another way. So in the same way with Hamlet, like, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into a dew. Like how beautiful those, even to start your first solo, you know, melting flesh, you know, and how would you portray that as a dancer, you know, as a cannon doll? How would you do that, you know?
Are there no cannon dolls in Hamlet? Because I'm willing to audition for it.
I'm starting to think we should have, you know, at least a special guest,
I tell you one thing I'm getting from this conversation so far is that, and I hope you can talk about this a little bit, is that after decades of mirroring someone else's movements, of being taught someone else's movements, you're getting something different out of creating your own choreography.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I still love to interpret other people's work.
Yeah.
Because in so many ways, it still demands just as much imagination. As that's why I love dance as well, because, you know, it's not like we're not saying the sentences that somebody wrote. We're actually putting life into sequences of movement. You know, it's a different thing. So that's also, I worked with Roland Petit, who's one of the most famous choreographers of all time. He was 91 or something by the time we worked together at La Scala. And I did a ballet of his called Jeune Homme et la Mort. And what was interesting is after the show, he came to me and he said, you know, he said one of the best compliments I think that anyone's ever sent to me is, you know, when I watch these choreographies, I've watched a million times. But when I watch you do it, it's like it's the first time. So I thought, okay, that's why I love to work even with other people's choreography. I think we can all have unique qualities that we bring to a role that's been done a million times.
But when you work with some of the greatest choreographers of all time and it's time for you to start choreographing yourself, I mean, you've been doing that for a number of years, but now with this project you're doing with Hamlet, it's a whole different level. It's sort of your thing.
That's right.
Give me an example of something you're taking from working with some of the greatest choreographers of all time that you brought to the work here.
Well, just like, you know, just like working with Alexei Ratmansky, mm-hmm. when it comes to the tools that a great choreographer will use and always be. A great choreographer is naturally a great director as well, because every movement needs to mean something. We're no longer in the era where you can just, you know, gyrate on stage and do fun things and people accept that, you know, not with dance at the level that I enjoy anyway. So every movement has to mean something to you and has to mean something to the audience, and it has to be completely driven by something. So that's the one thing I've learned from John Neumeier, who's a choreographer, Nijinsky, from Alexei Ratmansky, from Roland Petit, from all these amazing choreographers, is that first and foremost, you have to know why. Why are you dancing this move? Why are you doing this? How do you relate to the person that is on stage? How do you relate to your environment? How do you relate to space? And how do you relate to your audience, right? So as a choreographer, especially with Hamlet, I wanted to keep it minimal in some way. So it was only the movements that made an emotional impact that remained. So there was nothing excess. Already we had so much that was generated from just the mere narrative. Mm-hmm. So it was important for me to keep it to every single thing that is there has importance. So I would say that was sort of part of the creation. And also, as I become a little bit more aware of my my creativity, I become way more aware that simplicity goes a long way.
You mentioned some of the work you've been doing all around the world there. I mean, you were mentioning that choreographer you worked with who was in his 90s?
Roland Petit,
And where was that? Was that here or was that?
No, it was at La Scala in Milan.
But when I was introducing you and when we were doing research for this, it's very clear that you're one of the greatest and most accomplished Canadian ballet dancers of all time. My guess is someone at your level is getting Paris and London and New York, and you could have written your ticket to go anywhere. If you don't mind me asking, what kept you in Toronto at the National Ballet? What kept you? You're doing the show now in Canada. What's kept you here?
I think it's the people. It's my audience and Karen Kane.
Really, Karen Kane?
yeah. Karen Kane took over the National Ballet of Canada at a time when I was really wanting to leave.
Yeah,
and she allowed me to develop as an artist in very beautiful ways. She understood that I needed to travel because she did. She gave me lots of freedom to explore and to be with choreographers that I needed to be with, and also to create and to have the flexibility to be here. And then I got to experience both. I experienced all those beautiful big stages without having to leave. Also, yeah, Toronto to me, I love Canada. Mm-hmm. I love Canada in a way that I'm very patriotic. I feel like we have a really wonderful art scene.
Ironic, given the story you were telling me about being a kid in Northern Quebec, you know, coming to town during the referendum. All of a sudden, you're all fairly patriotic.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. And now I have two children Canadian, and they're very much Franco-Ontarian. But you know, it's a beautiful thing because I've grown up here, and I've loved ever. I also love contributing to the arts in Canada in a way that I felt like I've seen dance change in my 20 years in the field, 25 years in the field, and I still feel like there's so much more that we can do because you know there's a lot of people out there who still don't know about dance. So that's a good segue to buy your tickets to come and see Hamlet.
What was that? How did you describe it to me? Do you mind saying that? Because I told you when you sat down that like ballet was the art form that I knew the least about when I started hosting Q. And I came around, and once I started watching it, I realized I loved it. Of all the art forms I didn't know anything about, it's the one I loved the most. I found myself the most moved by.
Well, that's great to hear. I hear that often, and that's what I have this terrible analogy. And
come on, lay it on me.
And I grew up in northern Quebec, so you got to understand that that sushi for me was like this thing that I couldn't picture anybody eating raw fish in that way, right? Because I grew up on potatoes and steak, right?
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where, you know, I say that ballet is a bit like that. Like I really couldn't think of myself doing that. And then you have it the first time and you go, oh, this is really gooey and terrible. And it gives a weird taste in my mouth. And then you have the second time and you go, okay, I think I like this and this. Mm-hmm. Oh, the third time and you're like, oh, I really love that and this. And then suddenly the fourth time you're an addict and you love all of it. And you feel like you want to go for sushi every second day.
I love that so much. Because the big shows like Swan Lake and the Nutcracker are kind of like the bacon is like a gateway meat, and then you find your way into meat eating, and then you find yourself in Hamlet, and you're like, oh, okay, well, now I want a big roast. Okay, so what do you want from your next chapter here? We're closing up one chapter at the long chapter at the National Ballet. What do you want for the next chapter of your career?
I want to keep exploring. You know, there's a really beautiful art being developed in Canada, I would say, you know, from other creators like Crystal Pite and Jonathan Young, who have created some amazing amazing dance theater works. There's also, you know, all these really amazing talents coming out of the National Ballet of Canada. There's also all these different companies all across Canada and America as well. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have Côté Danse become one of those companies that travels around the world. Mm-hmm. That creates original dance theater works. But also, I'm always hungry for collaborations. So I'd like to keep collaborating with different art forms as well, multimedia and things like that, to expand movement in general. And also, I do really enjoy enjoy some downtime. So hopefully I can find some time.
Good luck.
Some time for that one day.
Lovely to hear about your path. I'm so excited for the new path that you're on. You've been a big part of my own ballet learnings.
Good.
You were the first ballet dancer I think I spoke to on the show.
Amazing.
So it's great to get a chance to talk to you again. Good luck with everything.
Thank you. And I'm glad that I was able to contribute to your love to dance.
Thank you so much for introducing me to sushi. I appreciate it. Guillaume Côté is a principal dancer, choreographer, and artistic director. He'll be retiring from the National Ballet of Canada after the 2024-2025 season with a special program called Adieu, a celebration of Guillaume Côté. So stick around for more details about that when we have them. Guillaume stars in Hamlet, a collaboration with the playwright and director Robert Lepage, happening tonight at Toronto's Elgin Theatre, going until April 7th. Tom Power, you're listening to Q. What's a good trip to Halifax? Get a Donair? Maybe you get a pint at the Old Triangle? Maybe you run into a trailer park boy at Sobeys? Toby had a good trip to Halifax. Toby's the artist you're listening to right now. He won 2 Junos at the awards that took place not that long ago in Halifax. He won the Juno for Rap Album of the Year and Rap Single of the Year. The album is Panic. The single is Someone I Knew. It's a beautiful album. And as Toby and I talk about, it's something that doesn't sound like anything else happening in Canadian hip hop right now. So it was interesting and cool to see it be rewarded as a Rap Album of the Year. So Toby came into the studio to talk a little bit about it, to talk you through one of the tracks, the track that won the award, and to talk a little bit about a shared humanity that runs through all of his music. Here's my conversation with Toby. How are you?
I'm really good, man. Really good.
I saw you right before you won the Junos.
Yeah.
And I saw you right after you won the Junos.
Yeah.
It was pretty exciting. Talk to me. Which one was first? Was it Album of the Year was the first one?
No, single of the year.
So, okay, single of the year is the first one. How do you react when you hear that, when your name gets announced?
That one, I was a little bit surprised because, obviously, I love my record, and I think that my record deserved to win. But, you know, just sometimes you think about metrics, too. You know what I mean? You think about metrics. My sound isn't a mainstream sound. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it is definitely occupying a lane of its own. So I was a little bit surprised, but I was happy about it.
What went through your head while you were walking up there?
That I was about to deliver this, like, speech that I'd been prepping in my head, and then prior to, the announcer was like, yeah, you guys only have 30 seconds and we're being strict about it. So I was like, all right, let me give you the abridged version.
And then you get to do another 30 seconds because then you win Rap Album of the Year.
Yeah.
What goes through your head when you win that one?
I was like, okay, this is perfect, because now I do have to get this. I got to get this line off. There was a line that I wanted to get off all night. And that was basically that when it comes to, like, marginalized people, right? Like, once the idea of, like, liberating people who are the least in society, not just for charity's sake, but for all our collective sake, because once you liberate the least of people, you liberate everybody, in essence.
I want to show my respect to the marginalized people, like I said, because I'm going to use this time to say, as we liberate the least of us, we liberate all of us. So we got to keep that in mind. Thank you so much. Love.
Why was that important for you to say?
Because I think that where we're at now in society, we are the most connected that we've ever been in the history of humankind, just through social media. And I think now we internalize other people's stories on a daily basis. And I think that it's important to, when we see these stories, to think about ways that we can lend our privilege and our power to help uplift these people, because it's a net positive for everybody. And I think a lot of people are tapped into that.
You see great tragedies happening all over the world, traumas, I mean, awful things happening all over the world. And you think to yourself, oh, I need to do something about that, because it's sort of my responsibility. But you also, you're saying that it should also be that it's the betterment of all humankind to do that kind of thing, to look out for the least of us.
100%. 100%. Because I even think about things like, you know, like refugee crises, right? Yeah. You know, it's things that are happening in another part of the world today will subsequently affect us in 20 years, in 15 years, because it's not isolated. I mean, it's all together.
That sort of leads me to the song, the song that won the award, Someone I Knew. So how do I want to start with this? I was sort of struck by the sample off the top. Mm-hmm. Tell me where that sample came from.
Yeah, so the sample is from the UPC All-Stars, which is a soul group from, I believe, Detroit, Michigan.
A young man died today, what have we to show? A country split into a left wing and a Joe.
And they recorded that song in 1971.
When I first heard it, I thought it was a new song because the lyrics are so prescient or so current. I mean, someone died today. There's two sides of the story. We're kind of ripping ourselves apart. Where did you find that? What made you want to use that?
So that one, I have to give credit to my producer, Alex Goose. I was literally sitting at home one day. He sent me that the bedrock of that song, no drums, nothing, just the sample, vocal sample. And I said, exactly what you said. Was this recorded last week? He said, no, this is from 1971, 50 years ago. And my body, instantly, I got chills.
Really?
And I thought, what if I played with the concept of time? What if I played with the concept of the past, the present, and the future? Because it sounds like it's from last week, but it was from 50 years ago.
What do you mean by you wanted to play with the past and the present and the future? Help me understand that better.
I was thinking, you know, let's say the people who made this song, when they made the song, they were like 20 years old when they made it.
Yeah.
What would it look like if I was talking to the 20-year-old version of them right now?
Yeah.
Right? And how do I have these conversations with myself, with the 15-year-old version of myself on the same record? And yeah, that I can't even explain why I did that. It just is what it is. It just came to be.
So I was struck by a couple of stories and sort of lyrics within the song. So at one point in the same verse, you mention where you were when 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and where you were when where were you when you held a gun for the first time? Mm-hmm. Why were those two events something you were interested in exploring in the song?
Anybody that was a conscious human being at that time knows what they were doing, because I've had these conversations with people who've heard the song. They're like, yo, I know exactly what I was doing. I know exactly where I was.
I was outside the junior high in St. John's talking to two people, and I could say their names. I could picture them right now and tell you where I was when I heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's powerful.
How old were you?
I think I was 8 years old or 7 years old.
Do you remember hearing about it?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. I remember it.
Where were you?
I was in Nigeria. I was in Nigeria. I know the street. I was on the street called Ralph Williams. And I just remember like the emotions entangled with that, with my family, with the people in my neighborhood. Like it was fear.
So why did that make it into the way of the, it was fear.
Fear. Yeah.
Yeah. It was fear.
Yeah.
Why did that make it into the song?
Because that was a moment to me that I'll never forget. Like, I don't remember what happened the week before when I was 7 years old. I don't remember what August 25th was. I don't remember what October 12th was when I was 7 years old, but I remember September 11th because of how strong the emotions attached to that day was for me. And the overall theme is that in any section of the world right now, we are technically all going through the same things at the same time. You know, these global events, it's all of us at the same time. And I was hoping that would like unify us and say, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. Technically, we're all affected by the same forces, just in different, you know, degrees.
There's a shared humanity there.
Yeah.
There's another line in the song that really struck me. You said, sometimes I ask myself, am I an artist or an archive of hard times?
Right.
What does that mean?
So to me, I think being an artist is the most liberating thing personally. Not just being a musician, just being an artist, because it's expression and being free and there's no rules to it. But then when I recant all these stories in the song, I'm like, wow, this is a lot of traumatic stuff. You know what I'm saying?
The first time you held a gun, going through 9/11, Michael Jackson dying, people dying, you know, incredibly unjust deaths that comes up over and over and over again in the song. Right. A lot of bad stuff.
Yeah, absolute. But the thing is, everybody to a certain extent has a trail of things that have been negative in their lives. And then the goal is, or the hope is, at some point in your adulthood or in your growth, you can address those things and change course, or maybe even just reinterpret it. You know what I mean?
I sort of read it as whether you were doubting yourself, like whether you were asking yourself, hey, am I an artist? Am I being free? Am I speaking? Not, no disrespect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Am I an artist? Am I speaking free? Or have I become, given that I'm speaking about all these traumas in the world, have I become just sort of like a library of hardship?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
I sort of felt, I wondered if that's what you were getting at in the song.
I mean, the subconscious works in mysterious ways, man.
So is that your polite way of saying no?
I'm saying who knows? You know, for real, just to be super like candid with you, like sometimes the process is just happening and I'm just like present for it. You know, I could be as intentional as possible, but I can't explain why Alex sent me that sample. I can't explain why the UBC All-Stars decided to make those lyrics. So, you know, if that's how you've interpreted it, I think there's validity to that.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce the song?
Absolutely. What's going on? My name is Toby, and this is Someone I Knew.
show up on time to the party. Yes, we the tardiest. Never good at chronology. I measure time and memories. Where were you when the towers fell? I was 7. Sitting at home, auntie bust through the dough in a frenzy. Facing horror shock, yelling at moms in the kitchen. I pretend I wasn't listening, but still paying attention. Life is a gift, and if God wills it, living. Inshallah, we don't face the world with a stigma. Where were you when you first held a gun? I was 5, playing hide and seek in my parents' room. Went under the bed, the perfect spot for me to hide. Dark brown mahogany handle on my hand like camouflage. Where were you when Michael died? I was 15, the singer I idolized, immortalized in my mind. Living with my cousins in a foreign land. Sitting in the living rooms, wishing my spin move could hang. My nose used to look like his. Maybe God's a magician and we look like twins. Maybe one day I'm taking off the runway and floating with the sun rays around. Though my tongue weighs me down, my mind roaming cause I'm fly, homie. In and out of states, I done spend way too much time zoning. I try to look up to the skies with my eyes open, but I'm blindfolded by the lies that they all told me. Close to his intuition, praying for forgiveness from the patron saint of sinners.
That is a true story. When I heard that sample for the first time, I was like, oh, so Toby made like an old sounding sample. He felt the same way I did. He can't believe that thing came out 50 years ago. From his Juno winning album Panic, that's the Canadian rapper Toby with his Juno winning single Someone I Knew. That album is out everywhere now. That is it for the show this week. The show, as always, produced by the best team in radio and podcasting. Ben Edwards, Vanessa Greco, Lise Hossein, Vanessa Nigro, Corey Najawan, Mitch Pollack, and Catherine Stockhausen. Our digital team is Shuli Grossman-Gray, March McKenty, and Vivian Rashad. Our podcast producer is Caitlin Swan. Our director is Matthew Murphy. Our engineer is Gabby Hagarillas. Our senior producer is Beza Seifa. And McKeegan is our executive producer. My name is Tom Power. I'm the host of the program. If you want to follow me on Instagram, be my guest at Tom Joe Power on Instagram. Email? Ooh, you better believe you can email me. q@cbc.ca. At your leisure. I'll read it. I got nothing to do. I'll read it. We'll talk to you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.